Hi, this is the Dark Tangent. And the speeches you're about to listen to were recorded at DEF CON 6, which was held in July 31st to August 2nd, 1998, at the Plaza Hotel and Casino in Old Downtown Las Vegas. These speeches are copyright, non-commercial use, educational uses only. If you'd like to use them for any other purpose, please contact DEF CON at www.defcon.org or email to dtangent, that's D-T-A-N-G-E-N-T, at defcon.org. Now, some of the speeches were lost, so you're getting what we've got recorded. Now sit back and relax, and here comes some knowledge to your head.
It's time to introduce the masters of disinformation, the divinity of the bovinity, the cult of the dead cow, with their new back-orbit technique.
I'm sure some of you have heard about our new program that we're releasing here at DEF CON. It's called Back Orifice. Basically, Back Orifice is it was originally designed to control satellites, but it turned out that satellites were all networked together and you could actually put a whole bunch of other stuff. And then we, kind of added some TCP/IP stuff. Oh, come on, man. You know this is all true.
Yeah. This is crap! You heard it's a hoax. It is not real.
This is not a hoax. This is real.
Easiest test ready to fight. Light out!
I know what it's all about. But we're going to raise from the app. around for the last 20 years with a new concept. You might have heard about it, but we like to call it Hacktivision. Because it ain't just about hacking for fun. Nah, there's a point to it. Beyond just having a good time and sitting around when you're bored of all time. Nah, let's be on that. What time? And you've like to introduce Sweet Fish to go with that concept. Here you go.
Grandmaster Rat, ladies and gentlemen, our fearless leader, Grandmaster Rat. There's none like him, there never will be. So a lot of you have heard me speak before and heard the TDC speak before, because we've been saying this for many years, that we are reaching out, that we want something from the hacker community. We want you to help us. We want you to give back to the TDC. We want to help you with this. We want to help you do whatever you can to make the cow stronger. And I know a lot of you, that you've heard this, talk about this at cons, you've read about this in files, and you're like, well, that's a lot of hype. I can't help the TDC. That is no longer true. Hacktivision, what we have here, this is a concept and a series of tools and a whole methodology that takes the slacker ethic out of all of you people. We are making it easy enough that an 8-year-old can make a difference, can fuck shit up a little bit for the cult of the next half. Now you saw Swamp Rat, you saw that energy, you know what we're about to do, you know that this ain't no fucking hoax. You know that this is real. You know how powerful this is. I want everyone to take this message and go back and listen to what they've heard today and download the tools that we've made available and think about some of the shit that we've been working with. Think about the Hong Kong bonds and think about where you fit in that and how you can do that too. This is for real. Up to this, you slackers. Get going. Anyhow, Harry wants to talk a little bit about back orifice and its potential effect on you weird kids out there.
To announce that that where the one thing I can say to you is the most important, know your career, know your sources, be very careful. May I please introduce you to the brainchild behind Back Orifice, Sardistic!
Real. Well, I'm sure you've heard a little bit about Back Orifice, and what Back Orifice basically is it's a client-server application where the server portion runs on a Windows box and the client application runs on another box. The server and the client communicate to each other via encrypted BGP packets and basically allow you to control and cause things to happen on the server from the client. This obviously can be run across the internet, which is a very convenient TCP/IP connection. And I am actually just going to give you a demonstration of what it does. First of all, the server is self-contained and self-installing. It is currently 120K or so, which is pretty small for a Windows application. I get to hold the mic and type too, so forgive me. Oh, here we go. Okay, so here is the server, eoserve.exe, 123k. Basically, I'm going to, unfortunately, we only can see the client portion of the software from here because the server doesn't have a projector hooked up to it. But I can assure you that not much happens on the server. It's entirely transparent. The most the server machine sees is disk access. No port on it. So, first, let's install it. Now, even on the internet, as you've read any of my files, you will know that an incredibly large proportion of Windows users seem to have their entire hard drive exported writable with no password. I don't know. I don't know why. I'm sure they have some reason for it. They probably just don't realize that after they connect to the internet from their local LAN, they still have everything exported. So, if a server has its entire boot drive exported writable, as many do, it's incredibly easy to install the server. Like I said, it's self-installing. You simply upload it to their startup directory. However, in this case, I'm connecting to somebody's inbox, which is fairly typical for them to have their inbox exported, got to get files. And so I'll upload the server. What's that? Oh, the server currently only runs on Windows 95/98. In a couple of weeks, it will also support NT with the same functionality. So basically, it just needs to be uploaded as you have to get a person to run it. Oh, there's a zillion ways to install. Like I said, all you have to do is run the program. I'm sorry? Well, there's buffer overflows. Dildog has created some very nice buffer overflows, which can be used to run any code you want. You could, in theory, run BackOffice. Oh, look. We're now getting responses from the server. So let's go down the list of commands that we have available to us. We'll start with simple stuff like file.io. We can, of course, view files that are on the machine. Oh, yeah, scary, I know. We can, of course, do simple stuff like create directories, blah, 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 copy files, blah, blah, blah. We also have full control over the network, however. So we can, for instance, list the exports available on that machine. With passwords. Remarkably, the enumerate export on Windows lists the passwords as well in plain text. So you can, of course, also create your own exports. Turns out that there's a cute little thing you can do in Windows. You can basically say, well, this share is a system password, and the remarkable thing about that is that it doesn't show up as being exported on that machine. It's only visible from internal machines. So now their entire C drive is exported with no password. If you're not familiar with Windows networking, shares that end in a dollar sign are not typically viewable to net view type commands. However, remarkably, using the Samba client, they list just fine. And encryption. So we can, like I said, create exports. It also has an integrated HTTP server, which allows you to transfer files to and from the machine, whether or not it has network sharing enabled once the server is running on the machine. So let's go ahead and enable the. We got Internet Explorer on here. Yeah, sure. Oh yeah. Alright, so. So.
Go away! Goddamn Windows!
Oh, yeah, that works. 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, Thank you. All right. Well, anyway, gosh, I wish I had Netscape on here.
Yeah.
Let's go back to our client. So the client runs on currently NT-R95. There's also a console-based client. Was that Nancy Reagan? There's also a console-based client that runs on Windows, or there will soon be a Unix version of it as well. So while we're working on this, I'm going to go ahead and enable keyboard logging so that we can take a look at that later. Oh, you didn't see it because you can't see the server side, but after the server is executed, it also deletes itself, which is probably very confusing for a user who sees big tits on EXE, runs it, and then all of a sudden it's not there anymore. But then again, Windows does screw shit like that anyway. So, let's see. That's a remarkable thing about BackOrifice is, you know, I've heard many people accuse me of already putting BackOrifice on their machine and doing bad things to them, and I'm pretty sure it's just Windows fucking up on its own. So, let's see. Let's look at some of the multimedia capabilities. Let's go ahead and list the video capture devices, see what's hooked up to this machine. Oh, look, we have a colored quick cam. Let's capture a frame off that quick cam. It's remarkably easy to use. Every command takes 0, 1, or 2 commands. And we now have a frame capture from that video. That was the export I created earlier so I could access the entire hard drive, how convenient. One of the funny things about Windows is that it, like, I just capture video at, or Bitmap at whatever resolution you want, and which is often 16-bit bitmaps or whatever. No programs that come with Windows, including Photoshop and all that, seem to deal with anything but 8 or 24-bit bitmaps. The odd thing is that what does appear to be able to deal with them is paint. Go big. So look, there's our video capture. Well, that's not a very good shot. Let's go ahead and try capturing an API. With audio. All of the same syntax for capturing a bitmap, except you specify the number of seconds you want. And that's all there is to it. You should now have a API in the root directory. Forgive me, I'm typing with one hand. opening. Yay, that BIOS 2 negative. Hey, look. There you guys are. This is by no way exclusive to QuickCam. Any standard Windows video input device can be captured from, be they video capture or quick cams or whatever. You can also capture screen images.
Nah, the whole world could. Microsoft's going to have to recommend removing TCP IP.
Oh, look! Well, that's what's seen on the server side. Do me a favor, delete on there.
Moral of story? Don't.
I'm going to grab another capture here. Oh, look, Nancy again. And Mr. T. However, I can assure you that backorpus does not show up in the control-alt-delete list or the task list or anything obvious like that. I should add that it's also configurable in the port that it communicates on, that the name that it runs with and the key it uses for encryption, which makes it fairly difficult to detect since you can't block any specific port or even look for any particular type of packet since it looks pretty much like garbage. So we can also play sounds on the client machine. On the server machine, I'm sorry. Let's see what WAV files we have on the machine. You can use the file find command to search for a specific type of file, and we'll say search from the C root. And search and say, oh, look, there's some WAV files. It's, let's see, need a
okay. Okay, now I'm waiting for these crystals.
Thank you. more than network commands. There's a network connections command, which shows you all incoming and outgoing connections. It shows anybody who's connected to that machine and any machines that's connected to. Let's see what else we can... Oh, we can pop up arbitrary dialog boxes with the text of our choice. such as something like that.
Yeah.
And there is a... Oh, sure, and the user has to click OK before they go away. I'll think about adding an option to make those dialog boxes system modal so that the user can't do anything else until they click OK. Let's see. No source available. That's mine.
Aww.
Write your own. Well, let me show you another little function here. There is a... something which I call application redirection, which is basically the ability to redirect a console-based application such as, oh, I don't know, command.com through a TCP port. Actually, backorf is currently, by default, backorf it runs on port 31337. That's configurable. And as you see, it's bound to 0.0.0.0, which allows it to communicate on any network interface that's bound to TCP/IP. One of the other commands, which won't be particularly useful with only two machines hooked up, is you can resolve the IP address of a net BIOS name, or really any machine name, which is incredibly useful if you're trying to control a machine that is connected both via a dial-up and a LAN. You can access the other machines on the local LAN, install backorf if on there, and then control those machines bouncing it across the machine that is actually connected to the internet. How would you do that? Well, let me show you this other function here I implemented, which I call packet redirection, which is very straightforward. You can redirect a incoming port to a outgoing. Okay. Apparently there's an emergency. If there's a Mark Edgar in here, could you please contact the hotel front desk? The hotel operator. Important. Port redirection allows you to basically redirect a port to another IP and port. This is useful, like I said, if you have a machine which is connected both to a LAN and a dial-up connection, you can access the machines on the LAN. Of course, you can just access it through the NetBIOS connections that the machine itself has, but, you know, you often want to do TCP/IP stuff, too. I don't know why, like, you know, there might be a Unix machine on there or something. And this is also, of course...
Wingate.
I'm sorry?
It's called Wingate.
Yeah, WinGate's really useful for that too, but it can actually be configured to stop that, just nobody ever thinks to bother. However, it's very hard to stop back orifice from being able to do this type of thing. You can redirect either TCP connections or UDP connections. I'm sure you can also see how this could be useful on the internet if you want to come in from or seem to be coming in from another machine other than your actual machine. You just install backorifice somewhere else on the internet, redirect a port, connect to that redirected port, and lo and behold, you're connecting from that machine. Oh, and of course Windows wouldn't log anything like, you know, connections or anything like that. So you can currently have up to, I think, 99 redirected applications, 99 redirected ports. It's fairly configurable. Packet sniffing. Well, packet sniffing isn't implemented directly through the program. However, there is a plug-in interface. So if anybody else... Yes, the FUD plug interface. So if anybody else wants to write their own little applet which gets run in backorifice's hidden system process, just make a DLL and see, where is the plugin function? Plugin execute. You say the DLL name, the function name, and then any arguments you want to pass to that. I'm currently writing a sniffing plugin which allows you to sniff any traffic that goes by a Windows machine. I expect there will be other plugins written as well. You have complete process control. You can, of course, see what is running on the computer. You can, of course, kill things that are running on the computer, such as I'm going to kill Notepad here just for shits and giggles. Process kill. Hey, where'd my notepad go? And if we do a process list, we now see that it's not there anymore. You can also, of course, spawn processes. There are two options for that, actually. You can spawn them viewable and in the foreground to the user, which is the standard way programs run, or you can spawn them completely hidden, detached, so that the user has no idea what's running. Like I said, it can be set up to run completely transparently on the server side so as not to disturb the Windows user that you're administering. You have full registry I/O. You can create keys, delete keys, set values, list keys, you know, all the stuff you do with GridEdit on a local machine or on a remote machine if it has remote registry services enabled, but that's hardly required for this. You can, of course, get system information. It tells you current user that's logged in, machine name, processor type, Windows version, amount of memory, and it tells you any drive information, such as remote drives, network drives, CD-ROM drives, etc. Let's see. You got system passwords. I don't know if, how familiar many of you are with Windows, but Windows has this interesting concept called password caching, which is, of course, for your convenience, so you don't have to retype your password ever. However, that password is stored somewhere in the operating system, specifically in a PWL file in your Windows directory. And there's this convenient little API which actually enumerates all the passwords in there. And it also will show you whatever the user has their screensaver password set to. You can reboot the remote machine. You can lock up the remote machine. The lockup is great. It won't be very easy for me to show you since I don't have a projector hooked up for the machine. But basically, the machine stops working, and all the user can do is hit Control-Alt-Delete, at which time it pops up a dialog box that says, the system is dangerously low on resources. Do you want to kill whatever applications in the foreground? You say yes or no, and then it asks you for the next program. And then the next program. And the next program. How does what survive you then? Backorifice installs itself as a service and gets restarted every time the computer does. Somebody is yelling from the audience whether or not it can be remotely deinstalled. Why? To remove your, cover your tracks. Well, the problem with that is that you would have to delete the file, and you can't delete a running file, and you can kill yourself, but then you can't tell it to delete itself after you've killed it. I suppose you could, yeah, create a bash file or put a command in the registry which deleted it the next time it rebooted, but then you'd have to have something that cleaned that up too. That's true. I mean, if they're on a network, then all you have to do is, you know, export their Windows directory or their entire hard drive and kill the process and connect with DNF files and delete it. I very recently added the TCP file send and receive command. I should note that, like I said, the port that the server communicates on is configurable. The port that the client communicates from is also configurable. So if, for instance, a machine is behind some sort of device like a firewall or a router that's filtering packets, you can keep trying different ports until you find one that's not filtering. Remarkably, port 53 gets through a lot of the time. For firewalls that basically block incoming TCP connections, I've implemented the TCP file send and receive command, which allow you to specify the file name and target IP and port, which it will connect to and either write the data it receives from that port to a file or send the data in that file to that port. Netcat can be very easily used with that command to transfer files.
Yay, Netcat!
Let's see, what other commands should we have in here? Process control, plugin control, NetView. Oh yeah, NetView is nice. It lists every single machine and network resource available from that machine, including all different networks like Microsoft networks or NetBIOS network or network networks. You can connect the machine from those resources and disconnect them from those resources. I'm sorry? If the machine's dual home, I've already discussed that. Yes. Remember, you can use the resolve host to get the IP address of the local IP address of that machine. We've been logging keys. Let's go ahead and take a look at what that's done. You can, of course, view a file on the remote machine using the file view command. What did I call that? Key? What did I call it? Look at that. It logs not only what is actually typed into the machine, but the window that was active when that data was typed, and if they hit backspace or anything like that, it grabs all that. File melt. The file melt and file freeze commands are the internal file compression and decompression that Backwarp supports. You're often capturing bitmaps and such, which, you know, at 644 80 by 24 bits are sizable. However, you compress them down and they get down to about 16K, and then you can use either the HTTP server to connect or NetBIOS or TCP file send or receive. And then you can decompress. There's also command line utilities that are included with it, which will also compress and decompress those files. Let's see. I think that may be about it. I didn't quite get to show you the HTTP server, which I wanted to do. Yeah, that'd be good control, wouldn't it? Sending keystrokes. Users sitting there and keystrokes start popping up. What's going on? Didn't take that. So I guess at this time I will open up the floor for questions. Wait. Announcement?
I have a couple of announcements about BackOrifice. First of all, since you all want this, I know, it's going to be up on www.cultechcow.com/tools as soon as we all sober up enough to get it there. And we also have two commemorative Cult of the Cow BackOrifice distribution/porn CDs. And I'm going to throw this out in the audience, and I'm probably going to brain someone, but there's going to be like a mad rush, and it's kind of going to be a riot, but get ready. And for those who didn't get the CDs but still want to show the flag, we're going to have five BackOrifice t-shirts on sale at our table for $20. There's barely any of them, so the lucky few who get there first, get them, go when we're done. Anyhow, questions for FT.
Has Microsoft said anything? Yes, actually.
They said it's theoretical.
Of okay, the response from Microsoft so far has been about three lines, which basically said something to the effect of, oh, a Trojan horse, how cute. You mean if I install this on my system, my security is compromised? What a big surprise. Of course, the answer being, well, yeah, there's that, but also because of all the other gaping holes in Windows, if someone else installs it onto your system, you're hosed.
Microsoft released that comment. They don't think it's a issue. Either they don't get it or they're lying. They thought it was something like Satan, so I guess they either don't know what Satan is or had no idea what I was talking about. Sure, PView shows all processes, including BackOrbis, but I should remind you that the file name that BackOrbis installs itself as is configurable before it's installed, so there's not any specific file name you can look for, and something like, you know, WinDLL or WinRun.exe. In fact, actually, I recently discovered that you don't even have to have a .exe extension.
So the reason why the bound port shown in NetStatus didn't?
I'm sorry?
Is there a reason why the bound port for BackOrbis shown in NetStat is hidden?
Is there a reason that the bound port is not hidden? Yeah. How do I do it? As soon as I figure out a way, it will be. However, I found that the typical Windows user doesn't seem to know what NetStat is, so it's usually not an issue. You can always, of course, delete NetStat.
The average user does sometimes get a virus program, and you know it's going to be about 5 minutes until the virus guy is out of your right of scanner for it. Is it going to hide from those?
I imagine that they will attempt to find some unique string in this program which they can scan for. I believe, and anybody is quite welcome to correct me if I'm wrong, that most virus scanners search for a unique string, which often includes assembly code. This program, however, is written in C and isn't going to include any particularly unique code that you could scan for. However, I hope very soon to have the self-encrypting version done as well. The question was, how does it hide itself from a packet sniffer which could be set up to watch for BackOrbis type packets? Well, like I said before, the port that BackOrbis runs on is entirely configurable both on the client and the server, so you can't block or look for any particular port. The format of the packets themselves, like I said, is encrypted. So depending on what key you use, the packet's going to look entirely different and entirely like garbage, so you're going to have a hard time scanning for any particular type of packet unless you're only letting known packet formats through. Can you do file transfers via UDP? Is that what you're asking? The issue is how stealthy is it to transfer files via HTTP if somebody is sniffing the system? For instance, use the TCP file send and receive command to transfer the file off of the system, and you could, for instance, use the file freeze command to compress it before you send it so it will look not like the file that it originally was, but like compressed garbage. But the other issue there is, I mean, if they're sniffing and watching TCP transfers going, they're probably going to be a lot more curious about what these UDP packets going back and forth from the machine are, so I don't think that's too much of an issue. What would you look for?
Are you a threat?
One at a time, please. Yes, if you are monitoring for anything out of the ordinary, it's certainly going to set some alarms off. However, this isn't exactly designed necessarily to be used for, I think, what you're considering using it for. Backorpus is largely intended to be used with dial-up machines. One function I haven't shown you yet is the how you would locate a machine. Obviously, you know, when Backorpus is installed on a server, you would log the IP address of that machine. And you can either sweep an entire subnet with ping packets, or you can sweep an entire... Come on.
Hey, check two. Hey, three.
Or you can sweep an entire list of subnets. I'm here with a question mark. Yes. Like I said, the encryption is configurable before it's installed, and it will only ever respond to packets that come in with the correct encryption key. So the issue is, you know, could you take over somebody else's machine that is that has running Backorpus running on it? You would have to know the port that it's running on and the key that it's running with, and even if it were brute forcible, you would have to brute force all the ports and all the keys. The question is, can it be proxied? Quite likely. And if not, I'll have it done next week. The question is, can you have multiple servers installed on the machine? One of the unique features of Backorpus, as I said, it is self-installing, and and you can configure the name that it runs as when it's installed. But when it is run from any place other than its installed position, it checks to see if anything is running from where it intends to install itself, and if there is, it kills that process. This allows for very easy upgrading. You simply upgrade the new version and run it. The original question, though, is what about multiple servers? No, there's nothing to stop multiple servers on different ports and running as different names from running on the machine as long as you have ports and memory available. The memory footprint? Well, it's 123K executable. It's all written in low-level C API stuff, so it doesn't use a heck of a lot.
Yeah.
I'm going to turn the mic over for a second to Dildog, who's going to talk just a little bit about some types of buffer overflows and ways of implementing the execution of arbitrary code.
We've all seen what it can do. The question is, how do you get it there? Not a host. We've already discussed this, a couple ways of getting on the machine. You can go around natting addresses and stuff, looking for open file shares and drop it on there. You can send an email as an attachment. Put a little picture of the dancing bears in the front and get all those AOL users to pass it around. there's a bunch of ways, but one of the more nefarious ways would be to exploit a buffer overflow. Buffer overflows in Windows are notoriously difficult to write, and sometimes they don't always work. Different versions of different DLLs and different system configurations make it difficult to write a good buffer overflow. I'd like to announce that I'm writing a Windows-based wizard exploit generation tool. It's going to be called Direct Exploit. Version 1.0 should be available in about a week to 2 weeks. Don't send the email. I'll contact you. It should be available pretty much in the edit. It'll pop up. Look for it anywhere you find where items are sold. Call devcat.com. It'll be there. Let's see.
I've got a bunch of other ideas that have to do with it. Registering it as a bug process, popping up a little box. You know, the possible buffer overflow that wasn't correctly written, pops up a little crash box, and gives you all that. Registered DOM stack trace, that whole thing. Register your bug process, you get an extra little button in that box. The button will say, hack me. Hit the button, and the exploit kind of pops out of the file of your choice. That simply, you'll be able to do a one-button hack. Exploiting both stack and heap style overflows. If anyone wants to read up on and theorize on how this is possible, feel free. CDC number 351 is an interesting paper that I wrote on the subject. Just do a browse and peruse the file. I think that's all I got to say about that.
One of the other tools that I'll be releasing next week is a generic executable wrapper, which allows you to attach an executable to another executable, which will continue to run as expected after running the first executable, such as self-installing back breakfast. And this will allow you not only to attach it to any other application for convenient distribution, but it will also allow you to, if somebody wanted to, attach it to an executable on the person's system so that even if they did discover the program and remove it, next time they ran Notepad, it would be right back there again. The question is, how is it? Where is the server-side configuration set up? There's a very simple command line utility, which will also be available in Unix, which basically you just say, configure this executable, and says, okay, what port you want, what password you want, what you want it to install itself as. Well, you would run that on the client side before you upload it to the server, since you can't. Yeah. Why would you want to extract the information? Why would you want to? Why wouldn't you just install your own server and kill their server? That's basically what he just asked, and the answer is no. I mean, actually, there's no reason why I couldn't write a program that did let you do it.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you like it now?
Yeah.
You know, I take a look at the packet, see if you can figure it out. Shouldn't be that tough. No, the source code will not be available to the public. However, the program itself will be available free of charge sometime next week, available on cultedcow.com. Why am I not publishing the crypto source code? Why would I publish the crypto source code? You mean I might not be properly protecting the evil packets that you're sending my friend for? You don't. It would not surprise me at all if somebody could figure out the encryption algorithm and brute force it. In fact, I have very little doubt that almost any encryption algorithm can at some point be brute force. However, as I said, the port that it runs on is configurable, so without knowing the port that it runs on, you would have to brute force every port on a machine to find it. I'm not familiar with replay attacks. Forgive my ignorance.
Your action.
Oh, if somebody sniffed the action and sent the packet themselves to the server? Sure. So they get back an encrypted packet that they don't know what it means either. If somebody broke the encryption, would I release the source code? Actually, there will very likely, very soon, be a Java client for this available, and as I'm sure you're aware,
Java source is easily readable. It's attached directly to the executable. An easily recognizable what? Right. No. It's configurable, it's encryptable, it's fairly random. What's that? Right. The question is, if I sweep a machine's ports with random UDP packets, not knowing the encryption algorithm or key, will it respond? Of course not.
Either one of you. Are you going to allow batch? Are you going to allow client-side batching these commands up?
Batching these commands. One of the next applications I'll be writing is a convenient, easy-to-use MDI client for this, which will allow you to have on your left side a nice list of all the servers, and you can select 50 servers at a time and send the command to start to execute the distributed cracking plugin to all 50 of them at once, for instance. All
right.
Over there by the door.
Are you going to release an API so others can write programs for it, plugins for it?
Will I release an API what?
So others can write plugins for it.
Yes, I've already said that. There's a plugin interface called Buttplug, which is a very simple, you simply make your own DLL and you make a function that accepts a character pointer, which is the argument you pass it from the client, and it runs it in its own little thread and it's a little hidden process. One more, you, Pat, close. Okay, I know where this is going. The question is, if you, for instance, post this to Usenet and 10,000 WHERES kitties run it, how do you find those WHERES kitties since you have no knowledge? I've been very fairly careful not to include the embedding of any IP addresses in the server since it would be awfully silly if somebody said, hey, I'm owned. Hey, this is who owns me. I'm pressing charges. So there may at some point be an automatically executed plugin which can do anything you want. For instance, it could email to some anonymous or redirected account, which would be very easy to do.
Just FYI, the Pearson crew leaves downstairs at 5 minutes.
Right there? Are there any commands that don't give feedback? I'm sorry, I don't understand the question. Uh-huh. Sure, you can spoof the source address and have their response go somewhere else. I'm not sure why that would be useful, though. To confuse the guy who's watching these packets. Keep in mind, you can also redirect UDP packets off any other back orifice machine, and you can string about 50 of those if you're really, really paranoid. I'm sorry? Yeah, sure. The question is, how much UDP traffic is generated? Well, you've seen the output. The input is a very small overhead, maybe 20 bytes or so, plus whatever arguments you provide. I suppose if people were really concerned about it, I could even compress all that. But I don't know if it would be noticeable, if it would set off any alarms. I suppose that would depend on how paranoid the sysadmin is. Sorry? Where on the CDs back then? Take a look. You use them? Problem.
Yeah.
What's that? Uh-huh. Yeah? Yes, I tried to load a web page. What's your point? Take a look at your computer real carefully.
In the back of the pool. In the back of the pool.
One more time?
Does CDC have a master key?
You mean, is there a back door to back orifice?
Yeah.
Do you think I'd do that?
Thank you very much, thank you very much. This concludes our presentation. Our questions must wait until you have it in your hot little hands and control your shit and bless you. And we'd like to close with one more chair. When I say dead, you say cow. Dead!
Cow!
Dead!
Cow!
When I say rock, you say ass! Rock!
Ass!
Rock!
Ass!
Thank you very much. Good night.
Questions for them, they'll be about. And I would suggest this is a good time to go install OpenBSD while you still have time. He's getting the second slot. So Newman is in the next time listening to the schedule. Oh, Kai Dreams is lost, not found. If you found it, please return it to someone at registration. Thanks.
way, Paul Concher, the person who helped develop and design the super parallel desk cracker for the EFF with Barlow, is setting up a machine right now. So as soon as he's set up, we're going to go. I need everybody who's going to stay, and everybody else to get out and close the side doors so it's more quiet in here. So please do that. If you're standing by the side doors there, either just close them, so either stay in or stay out, so the noise in the hallway doesn't filter in. This is Paul Concher, the person who developed the Dez Cracker that made the news last week and the week before. It broke Dez in record time. Proof of concept machine for the EFF. Okay, with that said, get your ass out or stay in and close the doors. Okay, with that, I want to hand the microphone over to Paul and get started. Oh, and Paul was very gracious. He came at the last minute, totally unexpected. He's flying in. He's flying out right after this talk. So let's give him a round of applause for zooming in just for us.
So the project I'm going to be talking about here is one that we did in combination with the Electronic Frontier Foundation and a hardware company called AWP. I'll talk a little bit more about sort of how this project happened. But the DES data encryption standard is what really everybody who has got important data, mostly commercial data, uses to protect their information. It's got a system that's older than about 4 years. It's the most widely used encryption algorithm in the world, with the possible exception of RC4, which is in most web browsers. But it's a very widely used standard. You'll find it in just about any sort of a banking application. The security is very important, both from the perspective of somebody who's trying to build a system and somebody who's trying to use it. This machine that we built does sort of the, in some ways, the most obvious attack against this algorithm. It's an attack which people have been theorizing about ever since DES was first developed in the 1970s. DES is a 56-bit key. That means there are 256 possible keys. And if you could try every possible one until you found the one that correctly decrypts the message that you're interested in, you'll break DES. The reason that nobody's built a machine to do that before is that there are 72 million, billion keys, or trillion, trillion, I always get it wrong, quadrillion keys, whatever that is. It's a huge number. And the number will show up on the slide in just a minute. And the purpose of this machine was to show that using custom hardware, it really is very straightforward to go through and make something that can search even a key space this large. If you're, I'll talk more about the machine's parameters as I go forward here. I'm going to try to go a little quickly since Jeff was very nice to squeeze me in here, but I know that there are other speakers that should be shifted around. You probably heard of me from some of the other work I've done with cryptography, things like time impacts or work on smart cards. I will not be talking about those today, although there's interesting information about them on our webpage. We're sort of a more corporate than... Okay. We're a little more corporate than Dead Cow, to put it mildly. We do a lot of work for banking and financial corporations, but also do a lot of basic research. But we tend to err on sort of the respectable side rather than the... our objective is really to make good cryptography available, because if you want to have privacy, if you want to make it so that people aren't watching what you're doing, if you want to be able to protect your information against whoever it is that's looking at it, whether it's somebody doing it for criminal purposes or because you have political opinions that are unpopular or whatever the reason, cryptography is the only way to make sure that nobody's going to be watching your information. You should. One of the things that's unusual about DES, and I really want to stress this, is that brute force is the easiest attack that we know of against this algorithm. Linear cryptanalysis is, in some ways, a practical attack against DES, but brute force is really what you would do if you're somebody like the National Security Agency.
if you go off and build your own cipher from, you know, from scratch and you don't know anything about cipher design, it's very easy to make a cipher with a great big key, which you wouldn't be able to break with brute force, but where there are other easier attacks. The DES is a very well-designed algorithm, except that it was designed with this sort of inherent weakness, but it's an obvious weakness as opposed to sort of a hidden one. Yes, there are a total of 72 million billion keys, give or take a few. And to give you some idea of this number, if you were able to search a billion per second, it would still take you 32 years to go through this key space. So it's a very big searching problem to find the right key if you're trying to build a machine like the one that we did. There are a lot of approaches that have been talked about. There are probably a dozen papers in the academic literature proposing different ways of attacking DES. There are some that are software-based, which is nice to do in ordinary existing computers, and distributed.net is a beautiful example of that. They were actually almost approaching our speed at the end of the DES challenge that RSA issued recently, using a huge, huge number of computers. That type of attack is interesting, but in some ways it's actually made people think that breaking DES is very difficult, saying that these thousands and thousands and thousands of computers all working simultaneously, you know, that's extraordinarily difficult to organize. You can do it if you have the internet and somebody working to make this happen, but you can't break a significant number of messages that way. Several designs using FPGAs, which are sort of like programmable chips. You can customize the logic gates in the chip and make it do whatever you want, have been proposed, but again, those are off the stage here. They give you some algorithm independence, so you can build your hardware and use it for attacking different types of things. They're unfortunately much too expensive to be practical when you're working on the kind of budget that we were working on this project. And the third sort of general category is to do a custom ASIC, which is very fast, but the initial cost for making the chip, especially if you're not careful, can be very high. We, for this particular project, used a low-run, inexpensive chip fab, which brought that NRE way down, but that's the reason that people have avoided ASIC designs in some cases. The design that we made is fairly flexible. It lets you, for example, if you know that a message is just made of human-readable ASCII text, you can configure the machine to break it with only that information, or if you know just a few bytes of the message, you can break it using that, or if you have even just other sorts of partial information about which byte values can appear or not appear in the message, it can break those. The design is just a massively parallel computer, and I'll describe the architecture of it in just a minute. One of the nice attributes of it is it's extraordinarily fault-tolerant. You've got a huge number of chips that are performing similar sorts of search operations. If one of those fails, you don't want your whole search to fail. And the way the machine is designed, you can have flaws in the chip, you can have communication errors, you can have chips that just don't work. All of that's okay, and the system will keep on functioning. That's very important if you're using cheap, low-grade hardware and you don't want to worry about having the machine come down because something goes wrong in it. It's easy to use, and it's obviously fast enough to search through the key space in just a few days. The chips were designed in VHDL, which is sort of a C-like language that you can design a chip in. You can compile it. There are debuggers for it. It's sort of the chip designer's equivalent of a high-level language. It makes chip design very easy. It's not the most efficient way to pack as much as possible into the chip, but when you're working on a budget of $250,000 for a complete project, you don't want to be wiring individual gates together because you'll just never get it done. Each chip that we make runs at 40 megahertz. That's a fairly comfortable speed for a chip these days. If you go to an ordinary fab, they can do this. Each chip contains 24 DES units, which do one round of the DES algorithm per clock cycle. To do a complete DES function, you need 16 rounds. And this means that we can do 60 million keys per second per chip. So the little chip on my badge here can check 60 million keys in a second, which is about the equivalent of maybe 60 PCs running full speed trying to search the sort of a key space. There's no overhead between the DES operations unless the, with one little asterisk that I'll describe later, but it ends up being much less than, far less than a percent of overhead. The complete machine was built out of 27 boards. I forgot to bring a board with me, I actually meant to, but they're BME bus boards with a design of
the substandard, and easy to get boxes with power supplies already configured. Each of these 27 boards has 64 of these custom ASICs soldered onto it, which are connected through a sort of simple bus. The complete system has 37,050 working DES search units. Each of these is an independent DES function running at 40 megahertz. Of these ASICs, some of them were defective, and so those were not being used in the search. The PC that controls the system does diagnostics on the search units and just skips the bad one. Very straightforward, easy to do, and it means that you don't get bad data in your searches. The complete system checks almost 10 billion keys per second, and that's over a trillion S lookups per second. So if you're familiar with the DES algorithm, the basic sort of function that does the avalanche characteristics and the S boxes, that's quite a big number. It's not extraordinarily large, but it's enough that we can search through the entire key space of that many keys in an average of just under 9 days. Now, if you're searching for the right key, on average you'll find it halfway through your search, which would be an average of about 4.3 days per key using this machine. With the RSA challenge that was issued a couple of weeks ago, we got a little bit lucky and we found it about a quarter of the way through. Sometimes you might be unlucky and not find it until the last 10%. But by the time you've searched the entire key space, you should have found your key unless you typed in the messaging correctly. The entire system is a bunch of boards connected by a very simple bus that more or less lets the PC read and write registers in the chips. And there's a host PC which embarrassingly enough supports either Windows and not so embarrassingly supports Linux that controls this bus. We actually had that PC hooked up to the internet, EFF arranged a Metricom link to it, which was kind of nice so we could watch it running and give it searches without actually having to go into the room where it was. The PC sits there and pulls each of these 30,000 search units, and if the search unit has found a key which is either correct or might well be correct, it stops and waits for the PC to pull the key out. The speed of the system is exactly proportional to the number of chips that you put in it, so if you add a board to it, the host PC will sense that it's got this new board there, and the system will now search more keys per second. If things, for example, fail because you had some flaws in a chip that overheated or whatever, the speed would go down a little bit. And the diagnostics here detect the errors. There have been some, there was a memo that allegedly originated in the NSA describing how incredibly difficult it was to do problems like this. It was a memo that apparently went out to Congress talking about things like the number of interconnections between the devices being a problem and failures being a problem. And one of the reasons for actually building this system is to show that that's completely wrong. It's not a problem to have failures in your system. It's not a communication bandwidth problem. You can have as many of these things as you want hooked together, because all that's going over your bus is the keys that are either right or likely to be right. And that's just a matter of, if you know a plain text cipher-deck pair, it'll just be the right key. If you've got a slightly more generic search, it'll be hundreds of keys, but it's not an issue. The chip itself is designed to do sort of a sieving type problem. There is a huge number of keys, and the chip is designed to reduce the number of possible keys that the PC has to look out to a very small or at least a manageable number. The goal is to make the chip flexible enough to do as many types of searches as possible. And by letting the PC sort of sort between a few sets of false positive keys the chips turn up, it's possible to get more flexibility in the search. So the chips include a pair of ciphertext and something called a plain text vector, which specifies which byte can appear in plain text. So if you decrypt both of these ciphertexts, and if the bytes in both of those decrypted ciphertexts have the corresponding bit set in the plain text vector, that's considered to be a good key. This is a little bit non-intuitive a way to do it, because you could just match what you expect your message to be. But by doing this, we can say, for example, that we can set just the bits in this plain text vector corresponding to ASCII text, and if both of these messages decrypt to ASCII text, then that search unit will halt until the PC pulls the key off. If you configure your search so that the fraction of keys
that will halt is small enough that the PC is not going to get overloaded and the bus won't get overloaded, you'll be able to find your right key. There are two ciphertexts in there, but the second one is only checked if the first one appears valid. So having the second one doesn't slow down the performance at all, except in the case where the first one matches, and that's such a small fraction that the performance penalty is negligible. And I just sort of ran through this slide since I'm going quickly. I really won't describe it. There's also support for a bunch of other things like CVC chaining if you use that, or output feedback mode, or it's also set up so it can solve that blaze and dead challenge, a bunch of things like that. It's a fairly flexible machine, so really no matter what your dead application is, there's an awfully good chance that this will be able to break your keys if you were using this machine. The machine was built sort of as a project jointly between myself, Josh Jaffe, and Ben John at Cryptography Research. We're a consulting company up in San Francisco that does fun projects all day long. A company called Advanced Wireless Technologies, which specializes in chip design. When we've done chip design projects, we usually work with them. And the EFF arranged the financing and did all the PR for the machine. Between AWT and us, we did sort of the cryptography and the architecture, and they did the implementation in VHDL. The board and I arranged for the manufacturing assembly and that sort of thing. The reason for building the machine doesn't make sense to some people, because, you know, why spend $250,000, which is what the machine costs, to win a $10,000 prize from RSA? But there are actually a lot of very important reasons to do this sort of thing. One is to validate the academic claims that were published before that breaking DIS was fairly easy. There were estimates of machines that could be built for about $1 million or $5 million that could break DIS in this kind of speed that were published a few years ago. There's been a lot of criticism of those papers as not taking into account things that needed to be taken into account. This also highlights the danger in short key lengths. 56 bits is not enough. And 40 bits is what people in the government want. People want American corporations who are using exportable products and foreigners to use. This machine could search a 40-bit key space in about 6 seconds on average. So if your security requirements are that your message is not important after about 6 seconds, 40-bit cryptography might be okay. Unfortunately, the round-trip latency in some TCP/IP connections exceeds 6 seconds. So this really is not a very useful level of security. And this is not a terribly fast machine. We were the National Security Agency with a budget of $10 million. Well, it'd probably take them a lot more money than it cost us. But if we were to spend twice as much money on this machine, I would estimate that we'd get at least 4 times the performance, perhaps even more than that. And I think that's pretty much something that will scale like that. So for every time you double the amount of money, 4 times the performance, you'll do more optimization, you'll get more hardware for it. Of the $250,000 we spent, about half went to the guys that did the hardware. They were actually doing this, you know, for pay, the normal project. We donated our time for the design work. This also refutes a bunch of the government's claims. Provides information to the users of DES. There are a lot of companies, financial institutions, critical infrastructure, which is protected with DES. There are standards bodies that are still rolling out single DES-based standards, seemingly oblivious to the academic work that's going on. This has got to change if we want to get anywhere, and we've got to get stronger encryption. And the last thing here is to really demonstrate what attackers already know. There's absolutely no question that governments have built these machines. If they didn't, they would have been completely irresponsible. Because, I mean, the National Security Agency's job is to listen to stuff. People use DES to protect their traffic, so they have to be able to decrypt it. And the last thing is a fun project. There's just, you know, breaking DES is about as interesting a crypto project as you can do. I'm going to take a few questions now. I imagine there are going to be a bunch. I'm not quite sure how I am on time here. Okay.
You said that the way that it works as far as recognizing what the right answer is, that sees that what is decrypted in the ASCII range.
You can configure it to do that. You can set which bytes can appear in the message, and if different bytes other than the ones that are considered good have appeared, and the key is rejected. I think in the RSA search we set just the bits that we knew appeared at the beginning of the message.
we've run a couple of different searches on that. Once you've found a false positive, upon a key which passes those criteria, the host PC is controlling the system, then goes ahead and does whatever additional tests you want. That PC runs configurable software, so you can't change the chip. So we made the chip as flexible as possible, and you customize the PC to the specific problem you've got. Yeah? The design was probably about 2 or 3 weeks of work. We already had a VHDL DES core that was optimized for a different project, so the DES function itself didn't require any work here. The information describing how the system is built, all the design documents, the VHDL source code, is all available in book form in nice OCR-able format. If you'd like to get a copy of it, it's available on the CFF webpage. With a link to the people that sell it. I don't actually remember where you go to buy it. But I don't know. Does O'Reilly's website sell it direct? Okay. I'm not actually sure if this is available online anywhere yet. It is?
Yeah, I got it from O'Reilly's site. They're on the third printing.
Is the content of the book then scanned?
I got it at Liberty to divulge that information.
Okay. The purpose in publishing it is really, from my point of view, to make sure that people believe that what we've done works. I mean, there's not really any question about it, because you can go and see the machine. But there's been so much misinformation about this, it was really important to get these results published and distributed as widely as possible. Yeah? We're not, AWT, I think, might actually sell to people machines. If you want to buy one, give them a call. It's legal to make these things in the U.S. as far as I know. Email John Gilmore and ask. I don't think it is. One of the things is this machine runs fairly hot. Each chip takes a couple of watts of power, and 3,000 watts sitting in a small room doesn't meet some of the OSHA regulations, I think. I mean, it's really kind of makes a halogen lamp look very efficient in it. So I don't think it's going to be, it's not something that's nice to leave up to 7x24 unless you've got a big air conditioner, and we don't right now. Thank you. Something I'd like to encourage everybody here is there's a lot more sort of talk than action in cryptography in general. The academic work, you could classify as talk, but it's very important to have that going on. But there isn't a lot of good applied research being done. This project, some of the stuff we've been doing with differential power analysis, work I've been doing with timing attacks, work we've been doing on threat modeling, I mean, this is just new territory trying to figure out how to actually use cryptography and make things actually secure with it. People aren't doing that much. I would encourage everybody here to get books like Bruce Schneier's book, Applied Cryptography. If you're more mathematical, Handbook of Applied Cryptography is more rigorous and more complete, but it's not quite as friendly to approach. You know, learn about this, play around with it, implement things, break other people's ciphers. There are not a lot of bad ones out there. It's very, very rare that we do a security review that says a whole lot of things that are positive about a product, and most of them, you know, we'll just extract the keys out in a matter of a few days. So it's really an area where you can have an awful lot of fun. I think the hardware was somewhere around $80,000-$90,000 to get the ASICs manufactured, and that included about 1,800 of them. We got a little bit of a discount because the fab that did these things had some problems testing, so they didn't test any of the chips. We just soldered them all up because the system is so fault-tolerant and having a bunch of bad chips in there is fine. So if you were to actually go and do it again, you'd probably spend a little bit more, but ballpark $100,000. Well, if you have zero information about what a ciphertext decrypts to, you have no way of identifying which is the right key. So you have to have some information in order to separate correct plain text from false ones. And in this case, you have to have essentially 56 bits worth of information about a pair of ciphertexts in order to be able to make the search work. I can't think of ever running into an application where you wouldn't have that type of information. So in practice, you've normally got checksums, you've got messages, email, or text. You've got control headers that are encrypted, so it's not generally an issue. Yeah.
How large is the vector? Can you just
begin on a message,
the first
56 vector? Can you
repeat the question? How large is the vector? You need the first 56 bytes for the message, or any
bytes. This machine works by doing decryption operations. So in order to make this work, you have to have a complete ciphertext that was produced by the DES algorithm. So that would be a 64-bit chunk that was produced as the output of DES. That's available, that's what the DES standards say that you're supposed to be outputting. So that's kind of the normal thing to have available. If you only had a portion of that, the machine would not work with that. Yes?
Yeah, a question about the scalability. If you made it twice as big, and you have done it twice as fast?
Yes, you can make the number of chips that you've got is the number of keys you search per second is proportional to the number of chips. So if you've got one chip hooked up to one board, you get 60 million keys per second. If you've got 10 chips, you get 600 million, 100 chips. You know, it just goes up like that. Yeah?
How does this affect other algorithms, like triple dead and stuff?
Well, there's sort of a lot of different things that get said about key space. And this is the question that Bruce got earlier. And so that I'd answer. In the case, whenever you add a single bit to the length of a key, the effort required for brute force doubles. So if you have a 57-bit key, it'll be twice as hard. 58 is twice as hard again. Once you get around 80 bits, it becomes really impractical even the sort of budget that we'd be able to scrounge up today. On the counter side to that, though, Moore's Law knocks off at least a bit every year. Computers get faster, and because this is such a parallelizable problem, you don't need single computer microprocessors that run fast. You can use parallelism. In addition to that, there are attacks that involve birthday paradox type characteristics, where, for example, if you have a 128-bit key, but you have 2-to-40 messages, and you don't care which one you break, like if you're trying to rob somebody's bank account, and you see 2-to-40 financial transactions going by, there are ways that you can reduce the effort of the attack essentially by the number of messages you've got. So a 128-bit key where you had 2-to-40 messages might require, you know, 2-to-88 type computational effort in order to break. You can also further reduce that using some time memory trade-offs. There's a paper written by Hellman years ago about that. So I see 128 bits as actually marginal and would like to see 256 bits as a place where no matter how badly you screw up your protocol, unless you compromise the key directly, you'll be okay. Yes?
Yeah, Paul, you mentioned in the first part of the talk, you said that the algorithm that you used to do the decryption was somewhat non-intuitive. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, okay, well, there's the problem we're trying to do here, the question is why the design, what's non-intuitive about the design. What we wanted to do to make this thing as flexible as possible is to work on two separate ciphertexts, and only have the search unit fault if both pass the criteria that we've supplied to it. So in order to make that work, you want to decrypt one, then based on the results of that, decide whether to increment your key or try the second one. So you end up with a fairly complicated state machine. If you try one, you actually then try the next key in the first one. If it was a match previously, you sort of back up and try the second thing. So the whole state machine is running through probably a dozen or so different types of states as it goes. The reason for that is you want to keep, in the normal case where all you're seeing is wrong keys, you want to keep the DES search unit saturated running on the first ciphertext continually. Yeah? Question is how we divided the key space between chips. Because this project was designed to be sort of as simple as possible, chip had to work the first time, didn't want to have any problems, we went for just the simplest approach, really. And that was to have each search unit fix the top 24 bits of the key. The low 32 bits is just incremented each time. The PC control of the system doles out chunks of 2-to-32 keys to individual search units and then checks when they finished. Simple and very effective. Yes?
Suppose we know that we're looking for an ASCII text message and, you know, we go through the keys. Is it not possible to find
Yes, the question is whether there could be some wrong keys that would produce, for example, ASCII messages. What will happen then is the search unit that's running along and finds one of those will stop. The host PC will pull the key out, and then software in that PC or the person watching the machine or what have you is responsible for deciding whether or not that key is actually the right one. So if it's a false positive, the PC will make that decision. For example, if you know it should be a word and you see X, Q, Z, Z, Y, and A. Question is whether you see a message that was wrong and might look appropriate. There, if you have 56 bits of redundancy in the message, that's about the point. Well, if you have significantly more than 56 bits of redundancy in your message, the probability that you see a false positive that looks human readable is, or that made sense is so small that you don't worry about it. So this is all sort of a statistical type thing. It's conceivable, but if the probability is 1 in, 2 to the minus 100, or 2 to the 100, you just don't care about it. Yeah? Question is whether we found a backdoor in this. The key length, it doesn't really qualify as a backdoor because it's sitting there and staring at anybody who looks at the way the algorithm is designed. At this point, there are still no known backdoors in DES, and I think there's been enough research that I can say fairly comfortably that there are not any. If NSA is going to be breaking messages, I think it's fairly clear that building a DES key search machine is the way that they would do it. Yeah,
have you considered running the rest of the key space for which for collision?
What sort of collision?
Between the existing key that you found and anything else that might be a close or
just from inspect, the question is whether we look for collisions in the DES key space. Due to the structure of the algorithm design, it's not clear that there won't be any. There is the complementation property in DES, where if you invert the input message, you invert the key, and invert the output. But aside from that, there shouldn't be any. Yes?
What type of groups have shown the most interest in your machine?
The question is who's shown interest in the machine. There's actually been no statements from the NSA at all, which is interesting. It's a project that we've done with. There's been mostly just interest from people that are using DES. Some have been told from quote authorities that DES was good, and the standard is strong in what you should use. A lot of interest from people who proposed right from the beginning, and people like Marty Hellman, who said that the DES key length is too short when DES first came out, were somewhat ridiculed, and this machine, they're quite interested in seeing this machine shows that they were right. Yeah.
Well, do you have any speculation as to why the NSA hasn't shown any interest in it?
One of the guys who's bought it, Ben, you could probably ask the question better than I can.
Speculation.
I think NSA has known for a long time these things can be built. I suspect we built it probably a lot cheaper than they can. But aside from that, I don't think there's too much that should be a surprise to them out of this. Yes? Can you repeat the question? What is an S-box coincidence? I mean, the S-box have been analyzed by a lot of people. They have... We weren't looking for them in this particular problem. The results of Matsudi's work on linear frequency analysis are probably the best analysis of interesting things in the S-box. And of course, the work by Beam and Shamir of differential frequency analysis shows that the S-boxes were designed quite well. Yes? We solved that latest challenge with it, and the machine will search keys. As we were bringing it up, we tested all sorts of key searches. The machine is owned by the EFF since they arranged the financing for it. I'm not quite sure what the plans for it are. Yes? Question is whether the machine can be used to detect triple DES. Triple DES has a key space which is either two or three times as long as single DES. So if we had 72 quadrillion of these machines, we'd be able to search triple DES in 2.5 days. Unfortunately, that would make the power consumption a little bit larger than I would like to have in any sort of... triple DES is not susceptible to brute force attack. Question is, what encryption algorithm would I use to encrypt my files? If you're building a system, you should use triple DES unless you have a good reason to use something else. Don't design your own ciphers if you're expecting other people to use them. That's something that you shouldn't do until you've got a lot of research background, unless you're doing it for fun. But triple dead is the most solid and well-understood algorithm. Things like Blowfish, RC4, if you're careful with how your keying is being done, those algorithms are also perfectly okay to use. Dead is not terribly fast, so that's the one reason that people often use other ciphers. The Dead X construction is also okay, but triple dead is definitely preferable. Yes?
To take advantage of any of the shortcuts you discover in the software or the hardware design.
The question was, the question is whether we used any of the shortcuts that were available. The answer is no, because we, first of all, doing that would have increased the complexity of the chip and increased the probability that the chips wouldn't have worked the first time through. The other thing is that Dead is very, very efficient in hardware. So to have, for example, the permutations there simply uses wiring resources which are available in abundance on a chip. If you look at the design in the book, you'll see that we were very wasteful with wires in a sense. We did things that would be very impractical in software because they were cheap in hardware. So the optimizations are fairly different. Dead was designed for hardware, and it's very good in hardware, so you don't really need that type of software hack to make it efficient. Adam? Question for Matt's challenge. Matt Blaze proposed the challenge of trying to find a Dead message which has a characteristic that for the input is a single byte repeated, and the output is a perhaps different byte repeated. And we've got at least one of those that's been searched. I'm not sure if that's been officially announced yet, but the effort required for that is order 2 to 56 search, as opposed to a regular brute force, which is order 2 to 55. But the machine has a special little extra logic bit that is necessary for that challenge that you'll see if you look in the book. The problem there is to check whether your plain text is one byte repeated over and over again. You can't do it with ordinary plain text vectors. There's an extra XOR step that you can do there. Sorry? Any last questions? One more. A question is whether heat was a problem, and actually it was. That was one of the things where after the chips came back, it was sort of like, you know, oh crap, these things are taking like 4 watts and they're going to all burn up. So what we did is we dropped the voltage down. We expected the ASICs to run at 5 volts. The CMOS can run anywhere from, Ben's a real good hardware guy, but 2 volts on up to about 5 maybe. We actually ended up running about 3.3, 3.5 volts. At that voltage, the chips take a couple of watts. So when you've got 1,800 chips, that's about 3,000 some watts. The room gets pretty hot. But if you've got a big fan and maybe an air conditioner, it's fine. There's some other work that we've done that you guys might also find interesting. I don't have time to talk about it today, but something called differential power analysis. It's a technique of observing statistical information and the power consumption of crypto systems and inferring the keys from that. At this point, there are no cryptographic smart cards that we're aware of that are able to resist this type of attack. So there's a huge number of systems that are susceptible to it. It's also cryptographically fairly interesting. Oh, set the pictures of the machine. I'm holding a board here from it. You can see there's 32 ASICs on each side. They're spaced out so that there aren't ASICs on each. The gaps between the ASICs have chips on the other side for cooling reasons. Click forward again. Here's the whole machine. There are something like 5 or so boards in each of these chassis, which contain they're old Sun 2 cases, I think, plus a large pair of diodes used to drop the 5-volt power supply down to 3.3 volts. A hack, but, you know, it works. And that's when you're building. And here's one of the chips. The machine's name is Deep Crack. Because the air comes up from the bottom is why the chassis is on bricks. So if you put it down, then air can't get in. Oh yeah, $250,000 for a machine like this is, we use duct tape instead of nice metal brackets and things. But well, thanks a lot. I will take questions in the back afterwards if anybody's interested. I've got also some CPA information that if anybody's playing around with smart cards and wants to talk, I'll tell you what I can about that. So I will be in the back. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
There's a lot more information about this, a lot of the other projects we've done, academic information, links to papers on our website, www.cryptography.com, pretty easy to remember. So if you're interested, just look at that, but feel free.
Thank you.